Bit hectic, yeah. Though I didn't read Haraway, but I did listen to the Butler piece, but I did read some of Haraway, but I read the whole
It was
chapter.
nice, the Butler story being a recording. I was sort of just pottering around,
But
actually.
it was a weird recording with the computer voice, but
That was noticeable, but it just meant my hands were free to do
I
things,
agree. Yeah.
mindless things.
Yeah.
But, hey, I saw, I'm terribly slow on keeping up with forms, but I saw your link to your website and I went and checked it out. Looks amazing.
I'm really pleased. I needed to get it
Yeah.
done for the grant because.
Well, yeah, you need to have something to link to.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Sometimes I think if it wasn't for grant proposals and reports and things, like those are always the little pushes. It's
Yeah.
not that you don't have sustained productive periods between them, but
Well,
the
it's like
push.
the contest to they're a real push to get you
Yeah.
moving forward on your
I was
right.
thinking of doing Inktober this month, and now 3 days in, I don't think it's going to happen. But Inktober is the sort of drawing equivalent of NaNoWriMo.
Right.
It was just one thing too
I've
much.
been because I got a new iPad, the
Yeah.
iPad 10 with the pen. And so I've been drawing on them on the
Oh.
iPad now. So
Maybe you should do Inktober.
no, I'm not. I need to practice a lot before I get any good, but
I think that's the point of it, though.
But
Oh well.
I do find
Yeah.
it changes my right brain, left brain balance, when I draw. So I like the way it makes me feel. So
I've got my drawing class tonight. I signed up for a class at the community center on portrait drawing.
oh,
So.
really?
Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice quiet thing to do on Wednesday
Mm.
evenings.
Hi, Doug.
Oh, Jeffrey. Hello, Mary.
Hey, what's
So.
up?
Right.
So.
I like your perspective there, Jeffrey.
Oh,
Yes, window in the background.
I'm at my friend Mary Louise's house in Montreal right now, so
Oh.
It's very nice. You get to travel all the time.
It looks
Well,
sunnier there.
yeah, it's going to be my month for travel, that's for sure, since I'm off in 10 days for Colorado to meet with Marco and Heather and
Oh, that's right. It'll be a pleasure to actually meet people
to
and
actually meet people in the flesh as
yeah.
opposed to what this is, which is almost but not quite.
So I can at
You'll be able
least
to
say hello.
talk to them without having to unmute your mic. Remember to unmute your
Yeah,
microphone.
exactly. Yeah, I'll have to be careful what I say. Hey, I thought this the Butler thing. I thought when I was listening to it, Doug, I was thinking, this is so Doug. This wry sense of humor that she has in that piece that we didn't see quite as much of in the other novels, and it's so your sense of humor as well. So I could see why you like this piece.
Yeah, that's why I assumed I loved it, but I didn't know if everybody else would tag along with it. But Marco posted that he said, "Well, this is one of the best stories I've read in a while." So I really felt it just condensed what she was about within a few pages or 40 minutes of listening, whichever you chose there. Yeah, I hope we can talk more about it. Miranda said she cannot make it today,
Okay.
but.
And Jocelyn said she can't either because
Oh.
you're in this big grant proposal and I shouldn't even be here. I should be but anyway.
I didn't realize, Jocelyn. I was looking at your website that you put together recently, or at least posted recently about your website, and I didn't realize she was the voice in the opera, or one of the
Yes,
voices.
exactly. Yeah.
But I recognized her voice. I was like, wow, that's a powerful piece she put together there.
And my friend that I'm staying with here. So if you look up Ariadne Emerging on through YouTube, look up that name, and you'll see the video with Mary Louise singing in it. She's the woman that I'm staying with, my longtime friend here. And so I have all these singer friends.
That's how you do such cool projects.
Yeah.
Do you think it is just the three of us? Who else does that leave?
Well, Marco should be coming.
Marco should be here. Okay.
And
Katina stated she would be here, but I know she also does online teaching, so it might conflict with her schedule as well.
And Johnny might be here, right? Maybe.
Right.
We'll see. If it does end up being a small group, Jeffrey, and if you're feeling really swamped, we can make it shorter.
Well, we might have to make it shorter because I am staying with Marie-Louise, and it's been a, you know, I had my 3-hour class online yesterday evening from 6 to 9. We had the meeting with Marco and Heather yesterday at noon till 1:30. So my time spent with Marie-Louise has been diminished by all of these other activities.
She's going to start asking herself what she invites you for.
Well, I invited myself, but I invited myself because I had a gift that I wanted to give her partly, and I haven't seen her in a while, so.
Hello, Marco.
Hi, Marco.
Hello. Hi, Mary. Hi, Jeff.
So I am recording.
So watch what you say.
Huh?
Everybody watch what they say.
Yeah. So I don't know. We could probably start because I don't know that anybody else is coming, but.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. I did not necessarily have any speech planned or anything. As I mentioned, this story, and Jeffrey just mentioned it, it spoke of Doug. So it's really possibly the Book of Doug as well, but just the idea, like my exploration recently with dreaming, and I first listened to this story right after our initial meeting, which Jeffrey, you put together a lot of information of her biography or biographical material, and I was searching for more videos online, and this Book of Martha just happened to come up, and I listened to it and said, well, that really speaks to exactly who she was, what she was about. But just themes of religion and God come up in it. Religion into writing in a sort of, like the story, she's morphing again another story within the Bible with Martha, as she did with the parables. It touched upon environmental, the ecological aspects of it when she at first thinks, well, perhaps we can reduce this population to everybody only has one child, or thinking of the earth at first. And then she says, well, or God and her discuss that and say, no, that's not going to work out. So eventually it goes into dreams and imagination as the creative act of, in a way, it's honing in power to the point where it's not externally expressed. So dreams can be powerful. But I had one quote. I was looking through a book this morning called Awakening to the Spirit World, which is by Sandra Ingerman, which I'll just read a brief quote. But she's talking about the spirit world in relation to like shamanic healing. I think she's my friend turned me on to her last night, and he was experienced stress in his job and things like that. So he's doing explorations, and he went on a journey, shamanic journey, and he became not what you would typically think of like a bear or an elk or something. He became an earthworm. So I thought that was fitting with the other story that we had, the digging into the earth. Or Donna Haraway, which maybe we won't get into today if we want to keep it short. But I'll read this quote real quick and maybe we can go from there. But it says, it is with our creative imaginations that we dream the world in which we are living into being. This gift of imagination is a gift of power. We create our lives with our thoughts and words. In our culture, few are encouraged to use their imaginations in a way that helps develop creative abilities. Most of us are taught early on that there are only a few creative geniuses in the world, and that we are not among them. Throughout our lives, we were taught to give our power away to authority figures, who then determine the shape of our world according to their wishes. Well, that was what was. We live in a time of great change, and now it is the time for us as modern visionaries to own our power, to make our lives better, and to use our creativity to find solutions for what is happening in our world. All of this becomes possible through our focused dreaming. So I felt that was quite apt to this story and Butler in general. But yeah, I'll open it up to whoever would like to chat about this.
I felt there was a bit of an ambivalence about the dreams. You've described them as creative, but some of the discussions they had, they seemed like they talked about them sort of, I think the word dulling was used, like they weren't necessarily supposed to lead to making something. In fact, they were specifically supposed to be complete in themselves, like they wouldn't, the dreamer wouldn't be pushed to do more with them, which I thought was interesting, an interesting quality to them. I almost expected there to be a punchline to this story where we found out that the dreams were television or something, because of that sort of, yeah, they were powerful, but they weren't unmitigatedly productive of anything.
Right, and that ties in with the parable of the talents when Larkin is doing the dream mass stories, and she's mentioning how possibly her own mother, I can't remember the exact character, but they got sucked into the dream mass and became lethargic and out of touch with reality. So yeah, there is the shadow side, I suppose, to the dreaming world. But yeah, good point.
Hi, John.
Hello, Johnny.
We started early because we want to make it a bit shorter today because I have other commitments. So I had a couple of things I wanted to say. First of all, I love the Martha stories from the Bible. I have two favorite characters from the Bible, Martha and Joseph, the father figure, Joseph, because I think it's a different story, but it's such an interesting character person in the Bible, because he's the guy you never really hear from him, but he's omnipresent in everything. And he's the sort of present father as opposed to the absent father, but in a very gentle, unassuming way. So I really love the Joseph figure from the Bible. And the other figure that I really love and I have loved for years is the Martha figure. So she's the one who sort of takes on the world on her shoulders a bit too much and it has to be sort of coaxed into being a little bit more relaxed and a bit more, you know. So it's such a prototypical character person for our modern age, where we all take on a bit too much and we all need to be coaxed into being a little bit more relaxed. And so I really love the Martha character. And what I love with the way that Butler does this story is she never really mentions the Martha character. It's Martha is the character, and it's the conversation between Martha and God, but she never refers to the Bible stories about Martha in any way. So this whole thing of being preoccupied with what to do and needing to deal with, you know, it's so Martha, but it's so understated in the story. So it's this indirection that Butler does that we saw in the other books, where she's really saying something about Martha in relation to the Bible, but in this very indirect way through another story. So I just love that sort of interplay between the two stories. The other thing that really came up for me really strongly is because I didn't read the chapter. I read bits of it from the Haraway because I was so busy this week. I just didn't have the time to really get into the Haraway the way it would need to be gotten into. But this story reminds me of Le Guin's The Lathe of Heaven in a really strong way, because what is The Lathe of Heaven about? It's about a person who's struggling with all of the same issues that Butler is struggling with, racism and making the world a better place through dreams. So Le Guin's story is also about dreaming and reorganizing the world through dreams. And it deals with many of the same themes as this one does, but in a totally different way. You know, with Le Guin's sort of Taoist understanding of the world, which is different from, well, we can't really call, but although Butler's thinking is obviously strongly influenced by biblical ideas, she's not exactly biblical in any traditional sense. She breaks with the biblical traditions, right? So, and she does it intentionally, right? So, so it's kind of not heretical exactly, but it's certainly a bit not irrespectuous, but because there is respect there, anyway, a sort of maverick kind of understanding of these things. So, but I just find the parallel be the two stories to be really interesting. It would be interesting at some point. I'm not sure everybody has read The Lathe of Heaven here, but Doug, have you read it?
I saw the movie. I saw the movie.
No, the movie was terrible. I mean, in comparison to the book. The book is phenomenal. The movie was okay, but none of the movies made out of Le Guin's book have been very good. So there was one of Ursi, and it was terrible. But Doug, you should read The Lathe of Heaven, because it's this whole thing about dreams. And in Le Guin's book, it's, anyway, without sort of going into the whole thing and certainly not giving off the punchline, but every time the guy dreams, the world changes to match his dream. So he wakes up in the morning and the world has changed to fit his dream. So you get very odd things coming in into the world. And then a psychologist, because he goes to consult a psychologist, and the psychologist starts to realize that something's going on. And the psychologist tries to manipulate the dreams that he's dreaming in order to modify the world towards what the psychologist wants to do. And it doesn't work very well. But that's very Le Guin-like kind of thinking about the things. But anyway, those were my reactions to the story.
And that's L-A-T-H-E?
L-A-T-H-E, the lathe, okay. like the machine where you turn wood and make, you know, so it's The Lathe of Heaven is, you can see why it's called that.
I like the title.
Yeah.
It's on my list too. So maybe a future reading group. but Jeffrey, I wanted to ask, how much time do we have before you need to leave?
I just would like to leave like after 90 minutes instead of a full 2 hours, just so that...
Okay. I'm reminded that Martha's sister in the biblical stories is Mary.
Yeah.
And their brother is Lazarus. And I actually would love to refresh what the story actually is, because there's obviously that illusion there. And I think Butler, or the character here, is seeing similar personality characteristics or similar dilemma in the biblical Martha compared to her own self, right? And I think it's interesting, like, that the maverick kind of quality that you ascribe as well, because like this piece is, it's like on the edge between religious, spiritual, and also, I don't know, something else, like that quality of questioning or of challenging or of, like, it's based on freedom, right? The very first line is, it's difficult, isn't it? God said with a weary smile, you're truly free for the first time. What could be more difficult than that? And so, yeah, I don't have much, I don't have anything actually to say. I just wanted to maybe bring attention to that a bit more and bring it into the space more. I went to Bible school and I went to church growing up. But I find that I forget a lot of the stories. I forget a lot of what I heard growing up because I haven't returned to it as a student exactly. Like I did a course on the Old Testament in college, and then I've dipped back in over the years. But a lot of it is kind of hazy to me, and it's kind of deep in my memory, and I haven't like reintegrated it into, except subconsciously, into my everyday awareness or my everyday thinking. So I went and I read about a little bit more about this, so that I knew the family connections, and I think, you know, that's very interesting and poignant. But just to conclude my statement here, like what's interesting to me really in this story is the situation that this character is in, the situation of a conversation with God that has existential implications, like something to do with how she lives her life and the choices that she makes and what she does with her freedom and her struggle to think through, to understand like the consequences of that freedom and the responsibilities of it as well. I think that that's part of it, you know, part of what she's struggling with here. So anyway, that's all I have.
Once you started talking about it, I started going over the story in my mind, and it strikes me it's quite actually interesting the way this has inverted the biblical story, because in the Bible, Martha is working and Mary is sitting and listening to God. And then when Martha complains, Jesus says, Martha, Martha, you are busy with many things, but only one thing is needful. Mary has chosen something, and it will not be taken away from her. So this is a story in which it's Martha that sits and spends time talking with God. Not necessarily just listening to God, but just sits and talks and listens. And the goal is to find the one needful thing. It's an interesting echo. It's almost exactly the same words. They need to find the one needful thing that's going to save the world.
So in the biblical story, Mary is listening to Jesus because Jesus has come to speak. It's like a Dharma talk discourse, right? And but in this story, it's Martha, but it's not just listening to the master. It's like a conversation. And then the God figure transforms through the story. So I think that's part of that maverick thing as well, is that transformative, like changing the narrative. Like that's what Martha does, and that's what Butler does.
Shape God, like we in the Earthsea books. You can change. You can change God. The same thing.
Then it goes to essentially she becomes God, or God becomes her. And I hit parallel. She's black female, and so it's almost as if the two become one, and they realize, it goes with the God has changed from a 12-foot demonic type of all-powerful satanic figure to a biblical God to a handsome black man, and then to herself, to where she realizes, oh, maybe I'm, it's an epiphany. And then that's when the power aspect comes in, like, oh, wait, I'm not ready for this power. And so she chooses to step away from that God role. So it's very interesting.
That's another inversion too, because in Genesis, humanity is made in the image, or man is made in the image of God. Here, God is in the image of the human, in the center of the story.
Although there's some doubt whether he's really God. She's
it
careful.
It may be another story.
I was also wondering while I was listening, because when you said Earthseed, Mary, I thought, Earthseed, oh, like Le Guin. So I wonder if that's a clin d'oeil, you know, a wink on the part of Butler towards Le Guin, because obviously Earthseed came first. And so there may be a kind of a wink between writers there, you know.
I thought I had misheard you as well. I thought you said Earthseed. I hadn't seen the correspondence before. It's cool.
What do we think ultimately of what she came up with? It wasn't necessarily expected, that sort of solution that she thought of.
About the dream, about each dreamer comes up with their own version of salvation or damnation or something in between. I'm very attracted to that notion, and I'm reading this book right now on social dreaming work. It's a compilation of authors who are working with organizational dreaming. Members of an organization get together and share their dreams. And it's very interesting to me. And it's sort of a variation on that we're doing with some of the members of our community here are getting together and reflecting upon dreams as a group activity rather than an individual sort of exploration of a self that is separate from. I think comes out of a kind of Cold War narrative where we had these selves that had to hunker down and defend territory. And I think that was reflected in a lot of thinking around the immune system as a system of defense that defended this self-not-self kind of dichotomy. But I think that we're moving now towards, I think Le Guin and Butler, who comes out of Lynn Margulis, the biologist, who wrote a lot about symbiopoiesis. And there was one other author we were talking about, Haraway. They're looking at, something I think that people are calling eco-immunology. So it's not about a self defending against, but a self as a mediator who's in a constant communication with the environment. So it's much more about cooperation so that you can compete. It's not either compete or cooperate, it's cooperate so that you are in a position as a collective intelligence to compete. And I think that's a much more complex kind of way of looking at our biology and our culture, because culture and biology and nature, of course, cannot be separated into different piles, you know. And I think this is reflected in the story of Martha, that she's having a conversation with this God figure that she's who's very ambivalent about. There's not a clear self-other kind of, I'm over here, you're over there. It's much more of this God figure is this kind of shapeshifter, transgendered, multiracial. It would make sense that humans, if they are to dream about God, would be dreaming about something that could appear to humans in some kind of communicative way. But I don't know who said it, but I think it may be true that, you know, if a lion were to dream about God, would be dreaming about a lion God. So I would think each species would be dreaming about its own God as its own species, as a figure that could shapeshift within its own species, because I believe each species is unique, and I believe this is the difference that Haraway and Butler and certainly Le Margulis are appreciative of, rather than getting into this triumphalist human kind of at the top of the hierarchy kind of nightmare, I think, scenario that we've created. And I think that all of these writers are really interested in deconstructing that, what I think Haraway calls the prick story of the heroic male who has to save the world, usually at a great self-sacrifice to itself. I mean, usually the hero has to die at the end in order to secure that transformation. Anyway, those are some of my thoughts as I reflect on this this reading and our dream life and what a dream life could be if it became more sensitive to those, to that eco-immunological kind of investigation of the mediator, rather than pulling out the cannonballs and the artillery, you know, to defend.
That was beautifully said, Johnny. I'm going to have to go back and listen to the recording to re-listen to what you said, because I think it was so, I think it in a way describes exactly what we're all trying to do on the site, in the Cosmos Co-op Infinite Conversations as a whole. It's a very description of the field that we're working with, right? What's the author of that book, Social Dream World Work?
It's the editor. W. Gordon Lawrence is the editor.
Okay.
And there's two volumes on social dreaming, and he comes from the Tavistock, something. It's a psychoanalytic institution.
Yeah.
But he's shifting away from that sort of autonomous self structure to something more eco-sensitive.
Yeah. Good. It strikes me as running. I mean, what Johnny was saying, it strikes me as running counterpoint to our discussion yesterday, Marco, about the presentations we're going to be doing in Boulder next week. It has a bit of that feeling, what we're trying to do there with this idea of a kind of an eco, what do you call it, an eco-immunology, a kind of an eco, and working together with a group in order to get the field that, you know, so you get what I'm trying to say here. I'm not doing it as well as Johnny did.
No, well, I think my description has come out of multiple descriptions that I've listened to, including quantum poetics, and I believe there is my tuning into these multiple conversations have contributed to what I, yes, and the readings that we've done together have contributed to some of my research, and I'm hoping our creative research together will continue in this, I think, very dynamic direction.
Yeah,
but it just takes some reprogramming. I have to think differently about myself and others to make this happen.
Yeah, I can even hear some Sloterdijk in there, because of course the immunology is Sloterdijk, but we're adapting it to something that is more suitable to what we're interested in than what Sloterdijk looks at, really, in a way.
Right. And I think Butler, we read together, and the philosopher that we read prior to her, I can't remember her name right now. I'm having a, but the one on the dance philosopher.
Manning.
Aaron Manning. Yeah. I believe she's coming out of this co-creative impulse as well.
Yeah.
A collective intelligence that we're trying to start to map in more sophisticated ways than we've drawn upon it, or we would not. None of us would be here if there hadn't been a collective intelligence. But I think we have had amnesia for that, especially in recent elections. the competition that seems to be privileged in our culture rides upon waves and waves of cooperation. And unless that cooperation is there, this capacity to compete in a very narrow way starts to collapse.
But you say a collective intelligence, but you actually mean, and I think we all mean this, collective emotional intelligence. It's not just about, it's not the mental that we're talking about, it's something broader, right?
That's right. And cooperative as well as collaborative, and it's that affective zone. which is very murky and odd and weird and confusing. But it's what we rely upon in order to make our most intelligent decisions is those affects. And I believe that is something that the feminists are bringing forward, the feminists who are in the sciences, especially the biological sciences. And I understand there are more women who practice biology than practice physics. And I think that's interesting that there's so many women who are in the sciences who are attracted to the life sciences right now.
And I think we won't put Mary on the spot about that, right?
I'm sorry, Mary, am I saying something?
I am in the life sciences, and I wonder how much it's impacted me, sort of coming from a feminist background, coming from a very, I don't know the word, like communitarian background, and how that impacts how I think about science and how science is done.
I'm thinking of Evelyn Fox Keller. She wrote a biography on that famous geneticist whose name I forget.
The Corn Lady? The Corn Lady?
Yes, the Corn Lady. McClintock.
Barbara McClintock.
Yeah.
And she would have these sort of trance-like epiphanies where she would zoom in on the corn population she was studying, and she would feel like they were her little friends. You know, she would go into into that, and I found that at the time that was held in great suspicion by her colleagues. You know, her whole way of thinking about science and her relationship to what she was studying seems to be that subject-object grid, which is detached and free of affect, was absent in her work. And she made some sterling discoveries, you know, in her research.
Was she jumping genes? Was that what she discovered? Sorry, I feel like the science.
Yeah, jumping genes,
But genes that jump from place to place. Yeah. I think that work that has been done recently, the original conception of evolution as survival of the fittest and this very like Darwinian evolution in which mutations provide material for a survival of the fittest, and it's been things like jumping genes and ideas like that that have just overturned that, and I think that's I think that's super important because evolution has had such social significance. People are still trying to interpret social phenomenon in terms of Darwinism long after scientists, thanks to people like Barbara McClintock, have moved past that point of view. But that, yeah, for me, that's the tremendous importance of McClintock's work.
I agree.
So with regard to the dreaming in this story, Mary, you had asked what we think about it. And I'm not totally clear on where the story resolves, because in the original idea that Martha proposes to God, which she's unsure about, you know, she's uncertain, like she doesn't want to hurt anybody. She's afraid of the consequences of whatever she chooses to change, right? The one thing that would change, improve, you know, the chances for humanity. But in her first version, it's a private dream world that each person could have, and that basically would be a wish fulfillment arena for wish fulfillment, right? But then God points out the various potential problems like that, like people would become addicted to it, parents wouldn't care for their kids, the kids would be, you know, absorbed in their worlds, and maybe, you know, maybe it would take the edge off of the destructiveness that they otherwise exhibit in the waking world. But on the other hand, it wouldn't really impel them to improve the waking world. So she starts putting these different conditions, it seems, on the dreaming process, so that, well, they can have these dreams, but it would inspire them somehow to improve the waking world. And I'm just not clear where that landed. I'm curious what the collective intelligence sensed about that.
Well, I think we're in a, I think this is a tense area, because I think we can misuse a lot of this new biology to consecrate ourselves to a super organism where all of our insights and understanding are just pooled and maybe ripped out of the context in which we as individuals articulated our experience. I think that is that kind of neoliberal vision, I believe, which is running amok. I believe we need to rebalance, I think, a pluralistic kind of initiatives with very sensitive to the dangers of groupthink and the totalitizing nature of some of our collectives, where we try to make one size fit all, a cookie cutter kind of stamp we sort of want to apply to just about everything. So I think our factory model educations, and we've talked about this in previous calls, tends to encourage this totalitizing tendency. So I'm watching this in myself too, you know, rather than, oh, I think that's a good idea. Maybe I should just hoard it, keep it to myself, and rather than share it and see what happens. And sometimes when you share it and see what happens, nothing happens at all. But sometimes something a month or two later starts to appear that sort of took that idea and added it to another idea and added it to another idea, which has some kind of vibrancy in a network that is committed to that kind of openness, those kind of open frames. And the kind of tension, I think, that comes from being in a group or multiple groups that have an open frame, rather than one that is basically interested in, you know, taking as many ideas and utilizing them to promote, you know, a private vision of a super organism. So I hope that makes some sense. And how I believe that dreams can actually, our dreams have a lot of wiggle room. I actually believe I've had other people's dreams. And I actually reported this on a couple of times to the persons whose dreams I believe that I had. And they were very surprised that I was sharing with them information that they had thought was quite private to themselves. But that obviously that something of that dream report that I was sharing with them reflected that. So I don't know what that means. I don't want to take it too literally, but I believe that the Butler, with her leading character as this hyper empath, I believe was sort of maybe fast forwarding into that potential that our species has, but that potential, of course, is fraught with peril because it can lead to hypersensitivity and an increase of pain. So I think that's the, how do we find the boundary conditions that can actually work for bringing forward these telepathic capacities that we have without burning out and without, you know, creating all kinds of toxic flare-ups. As many of the empaths and the psychics in Butler's stories actually have breakdowns, because especially psychics can't hang out too much with other psychics because there's very little, the boundary conditions are so dynamic that it can create an incredible burnout. So I think those are the tensions we're all feeling collectively as we're working on the internet and working with our groups and working with so many initiatives that, you know, are open-ended and can appear to be confusing and perplexing. Yet it's that ability, I think, to hold these paradoxes and these tensions and to be with the ambiguity in a way that's playful and artistic that will, I think, you know, slowly but surely, humanity will start being able to become that companion species that that Haraway so much values and wants us to become.
I like what you said there, John, and it makes sense to me, though I can't articulate it quite too much. So I guess to tie into your question, Marco, like where does it end up? And also you posted on the forum, like what would be your own personal idea of, like, well, this story has some form of creative dreaming or forced dreaming as the mode of saving the world, for better or for worse. And I've had the notion of some sort of forced enlightenment for everyone, not necessarily to just reach that height of spiritual enlightenment, but more enlightenment in the sense that it's sort of worked out in this story where the dreams would be the realization of fantasies or this or that. But I see it would eventually lead at least individuals to slow down, to be aware of, well, when I can have 50 cups of coffee and a styrofoam cup in my dream, but in real life, if I do that, eventually, if everybody's doing that, it's going to be a trash island in the ocean or something like that. So even on that simple level, it's not some superhuman, I can imagine, as there have been TV shows and stories created of Unlimited, I think, or I can't remember the movie, but essentially he takes a pill and he has all these powers, and then eventually the pill wears off and he becomes addicted to this feeling, to this drug as well, and it sucks away his life unless he's on that drug. And he's creative. He lives in the business world. He lives out the neoliberal dream, as Johnny was saying. But so that story is kind of over to the extent that it's destructive. It's destroying our environment. It's only helping a certain already wealthy or successful population and neglects the lower end, such as our friend Martha here. She notes a few times that she's on the lowest end. She's a nothing. She's whatever you want to call her. I think the solution of dreaming is, it will be messy if it's proposed as it is in the story here, but there might be other ways. Maybe instead go towards just sort of an enlightenment to the extent that everybody is on, like everybody here in this conversation right now, we're not perfect. We don't do everything exactly right, but we have a certain sense of how to save the world. But as individuals, we can't do that. So if everybody was forced into that state, then we'd all be on level playing ground and understand or meet the, yeah, I think you said an open frame, Johnny. So we would all be in that open frame to be creative together, I guess. Maybe that makes sense.
Though it's interesting in this story that the dreams are, in the story Butler's written, that the dreams do seem very personal and individualized. I think both of you put your finger on something that, I mean, I hesitate to say, but what's missing from the story is is that aspect of coming together. That, because it seems to me that what Martha has proposed is everyone has this dream that's perfectly suited to exactly them. It seems very individualistic, unless I'm missing something.
No, that was exactly what I was going to say. Sorry if I jumped in, Johnny, but I think that's what's missing. I think this was written before the parable series, if I remember right. And in a way, because if you think about the relationship between Olamina and the group within the parable series, there's a tension there between the individual and the group that is worked out in those books. It's in a way the Urseed is an individual dream that became a group dream through the interaction of the characters through those books. And that's a very different understanding, I think, of the role of dreaming than one finds in this story about Martha. And and I also was, I said I hadn't read the Haraway all the way through, but I've sort of been skimming it as I've been listening. And so there's, Haraway writes, wind, creation, and death are Oya's attributes and powers for worlding in the parable stories. Butler's entire work as an SF writer is riveted on the problem of destruction and wounded flourishing, not simply survival, in exile, diaspora, abduction, and transportation, the earthly gift burden of the descendants of slaves, refugees, immigrants, travelers, and of the indigenous too. It is not a burden that stops with settlement. Anyway, it's this focused on, it's not just an individual thing, it's a very much a group thing, and I think that's more present in the parables than we have in this one. So anyway, I'm agreeing with you, Mary.
We're witnessing an author's growth. You know, we're witnessing the growth of a mind as Butler has changed maybe over the years.
Yeah, I wonder if Martha were to keep having these visions of God, that what would be the next manifestations? Maybe they would be, you know, an ant colony or a star cluster, or like suddenly God would start appearing in all these other forms that were not just reflections of the patriarchy, you know, as the first God is, and or of the self, of the individual self. God could start manifesting and speaking with her through many different kinds of forms, right? And I could see where this could go, in other words. But I think my sense of just the story as, you know, from a literary perspective, I think it's perfect as it is. I think it's a wonderful story because I think it really is about the individual authors coming to an intimate understanding of their own, the essence of her own work. Like, this is something about, I think, an author trying to figure out what they're doing in the world and how that relates, like this thing that this practice that gives them happiness. She's a writer, and she's even worried about the effect that the dreaming will have on her writing, because if people get too into their dreams, they won't read books. So God says you'll need to find another job. And there's still an interesting dynamic in what God, those boundary conditions that God is able to put on this game, because she can't refuse. And he says that over and over, that even though she's free to construct the world as she will, she can't not be free. And there was another interesting condition. It's escaping my mind, but what was it? I'll have to come back to it.
Does it have anything to do with ultimate truth?
I think that kind of does.
I'm teasing you. I'm teasing you.
Well, I mean, part of it is the not knowing.
Right.
That's one of the conditions. Anyway, I'll have to come back to it. My mind is working slow. I've been sick for a few days. And so I'm kind of I got something emptied through me. Like the sickness just like took something out of me. And that's like slowly filling up again with content.
So you're going through a renegotiation with the microbial world. Very necessary. Sort of a dance going on. I'm just wanted to respond. Because you and I have had some sort of dance around certain kind of issues, epistemology and ontology and reality. And, you know, I have a tendency to reality and being, and I have a real resistance, I think, to a lot of those ideas that tend to subordinate epistemological claims, which I believe are front and center in my imagination. And I believe I'm trying to rebalance. And I'm starting to study and look at authors that I have sometimes an allergic reaction to. But one of these guys is Wilfred Sellars, and he's a philosopher who's looking at science and the scientific image and the manifest image. So we as human beings, we walk around and we talk and we touch things and we smell things, we have perceptions, we have aversions. And then there's the scientific image that in our culture right now is sort of in its deficient forms becomes quite domineering and almost snuffs out that manifest image of that perceptual human in a particular environment with aesthetic pleasures and aversions. And I think that tension that Wilfred Sellars was talking about, I think is front and center in the imaginations of some of the authors that we're talking about, certainly Haraway and I think Butler. And I believe that there's something he said, and I'm just quoting this, about reality. And I've always been perplexed by what people are talking about when they talk about reality, because clearly what my reality is so very different from what the norm is. And so I've always had a little bit of paranoia about disrupting these sort of totalitizing schemes about what reality is, and reducing the imaginary as something that's different from reality and something that should be subordinate to reality. And this is something that Wilfred Sellars says, and I think he's speaking to this. He says that he's talking about science and the manifest self. And he says that which is imagined may well not exist, although the imagining of it does. But the imagined can exist, as when someone imagines someone is dancing in the next room and someone is. So I think for Man of Science, it's a very poetic description. And he goes on to talk about when primitive man, he was writing, I think, in the 40s or the 50s, when primitive man ceased to think of a tree as a person, it was more than a change of belief. It was a change of category. If the human mind can conceive of new categories, and I would say like same-sex marriage, it can also refine the old. So I think that's very suggestive, and maybe adds a little bit more complexity to some of our conversations, because I know reality is important to all of us and that we get it right. And I also think that what we imagine, that we are imagining it, imagining what we are imagining, it is real. But does it exist is another kind of question. And I think to some extent that's a pop-up. Well, it may not exist today, but it may exist tomorrow, like same-sex marriage, something that a few weirdos like myself dreamed about 30, 40 years ago. It's now a new reality. So, I think this is why fiction and is so important, and works of the imagination in movies and our pop culture is so important, because we find that wiggle room, you know? So anyway, that I just wanted to add that, this conversation. Thank you.
Well, I picked up the Tao Te Ching, and you know, the first line, it's variously translated, but the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao, but there's still the Tao, but the naming of it is not the eternal name. So it's a dance, I think, and language is ecological in that sense. And I think the master categories I like to use them more like Legos than like absolutes.
And I like to use them as silly putty.
But I think in the story, it's interesting because there is this conversation. There is Martha is talking to somebody, but God says, "You see what your life has prepared you to see." And then as her life, I think, changes, she sees different things, but there's still the seeing. And so that's, I think, where how it can open up. And he, another point says that, well, that your way of seeing is not a cage, because if it were, you wouldn't have transcended it. You wouldn't have come to this new imagination. And I remember the thing that I had forgotten earlier. One of the conditions, this is, I think, God exercising some executive, you know, authority or something, is that whatever world that she constructs, she has to be at the bottom of it. So that's an interesting, from a game theory kind of perspective, because you have to create a world in such a way that even if you're the least, well, the least benefited by it, you would have an incentive to care for yourself, right? To not make that be a hell. And so I think that the author hasn't even begun in this story to contemplate that. And I think that maybe that starts to come through in the parable books and maybe in some other, maybe Le Guin certainly. It's like also the legal theory, John Rawls, the starting condition, you know, create the, it's sort of his take on the Kantian, well, not the prime directive, what was it, the moral...
Categorical
moral imperative?
Yeah, the categorical imperative. But write the rules without knowing how, in what, how, I mean, how, who you will be in the world that would be affected by them. So I think the collective dreaming and the social dreaming, those would be the kind of, you know, like what would be the conditions for that? When Sloterdijk, you mentioned earlier, he doesn't talk about collective intelligence, but he uses the term interintelligence. And I found that interesting because it sort of gets at the same thing that people get, you know, are talking about when they talk about collective intelligence, but it puts the focus and the emphasis on the in-between. Rather than on the total, the whole. Mm.
Can you explain the difference between inter and intra?
Intra would be within a monad, within myself. So my intra intelligence would be contained. The inter would be between us. Or between...
Well, but isn't there something within the monad that can register the effects of the collective? That could be fed back into the collective. And how could that happen without dreaming or fantasy or imagination or language games that facilitate that kind of open-endedness? Because I have a version of the collective, which maybe and probably is very different from anyone else's. The way the collective has impacted me is mine. Yet I could share that, and other people may or may not resonate with that. And that will be because they're drawing upon their own experience of the collective, with their families, with their communities, with how they were educated. And I believe that as many of us as is interested, how do we recategorize the categories? I think Wilfred Sellers, who's basically a man of science, but he was just saying how when we moved from seeing a tree as a person to seeing it differently, it was a change not in beliefs but in category. I believe that is something we need to recategorize. I think we need to go back to thinking about trees as persons and reclaiming those perhaps primitive, what he calls primitive, what I would call pre-modern ways of relating, and it maybe have been very useful for us to have gone through a period where we change categories. But I think that we can recategorize, and our conceptual systems can become more complex as we play around with metaphors. That we will come up with more and better and more effective categories and conceptions. So I think this interplay between the perceptive and the conceptual is ongoing. And as we dream and take the risks in acting upon our dreams, because we are agents, we are active, we're centers of activity, I think that we should expect you know, we shouldn't expect a utopia anytime soon. But then a utopia might bore us all to death, and we would, you know, want to get out of it as soon as possible after a few days of it. Anyway, those are just my gut responses to this.
Because this sort of idea of category, I hate categories. I know we need them, but and we can't really get away without them, but we get stuck in them. And so, you know, treat a tree as a human being. Well, yes, but maybe if you just react to the tree in an ecological way and react to a person in an ecological way, you don't have to categorize either one, but the relationships aren't the same as if you think of the tree as a tree and the person as a person. I mean, so, you know, there may be a sort of another, but I thought what you said about the reality, I mean, I agree with you. I have a deep suspicion of any talk about reality, even though I used it in one of my poems recently, but sort of aware that there is an issue there. Because it's just it's a big bag that people stuff everything into is what reality is. It doesn't correspond to anything actually, except a big bag. But this idea of the imaginary and the real. So somebody recently described me as an academic unicorn. And I feel that I am living in my life right now with one foot in the world that we call reality and the other foot in the world that we call imaginary. And that this academic unicorn, you know, because I thought it was a really interesting comment, because of course unicorns do they exist? So, I mean, in the reality world, unicorns don't exist. So to call somebody an academic unicorn is to say, kind of, you know, you're a creature who shouldn't exist, but who does exist in a way, you know. So, and it's an odd juxtaposition of words as well. And you know, I sort of said, well, you know, unicorns are an extinct species, which as if they had once existed, but they're in the process of becoming extinct, which is a worrying idea for somebody who's been called an academic unicorn. And then I thought, well, maybe we could start a campaign to protect the remaining unicorns in the world.
maybe they haven't appeared yet.
Maybe they're coming into being. Yes,
yeah, exactly.
And then I was thinking, but in a way, everything that we're doing on Infinite Conversations is also one foot in the world of that we call reality and the other foot in the world that we call imagination. And so it's not just me who's on this. It's all of us. Anyway, and obviously Butler, her writing is right in the middle of that tension between the imaginary that creates the real and the real that create, you know, and there's sort of this movement back and forth between, anyway, I'm not sure I'm fully coherent, but.
I think you're already an exemplary unicorn. So you do exist and you're creating little unicorn babies wherever you go. So that's a good thing. But you just mentioned in the middle of Butler and in the middle of her book, I wanted to read a quote that's very apt with what we're talking about, but it's at the beginning of 2033 from Earthseed, the Books of the Living. It says, partnership is giving, taking, learning, teaching, offering the greatest possible benefit while doing the least possible harm. Partnership is mutualistic symbiosis. Partnership is life. Any entity, any process that cannot or should not be resisted or avoided must somehow be partnered. Partner one another, partner diverse communities, partner life, partner any world that is your home, partner God, Only in partnership we can thrive, grow, change. Only in partnership can we live. So, yeah. So it reality, I guess right now my version of reality is life. It's living. It doesn't necessarily have to be categorized. So when we were speaking of trees, I've not seen trees as people before, maybe in a certain extent of, well, we have the subconscious roots and always branching out to something else, but my relationship with trees are always ongoing. It's always a morphing field. And just the other day, I climbed my first tree in perhaps a year and got a little scratch somewhere on my arm here. And it's a good reminder of, oh, I used to love climbing trees. I used to be in trees doing all sorts of things with friends and family members and observing the world from a different perspective. So trees are like dreams are kind of my totem animal, I guess, but it's a plant.
I'm just thinking about there's inter, and then there's extra. And I believe that's where dreams come from. They come from the extra, the exuberant, the excessive, the leftovers. And I believe that we can recycle that extra dimension, extra categories, things that don't have a home yet or a human presence because no one has paid attention to them. And I believe that this is something that Haraway with her cyborg manifesto was very sensitive to, the kind of strange hybrids and the Frankensteinian kind of new creatures that our bioinformations may start to give life to. And it might be kind of scary and kind of repugnant when they start splicing tomatoes with salmon, you know, different species, in order to preserve the tomato forever, you know. This is evidently something that's ongoing. And of course, it won't be organic anymore. But I think that Haraway sort of has an affection for, expresses a kind of, you know, affection for these freaks, you know, these anomalies that are our new biology, driven by the Pentagon and Wall Street and, you know, hunker down defense kind of mentalities, will probably sponsor, and the current AI wave. Not all of that I think should be dismissed, but I think some of it needs to be recategorized differently. And I hope there'll be enough well-informed people who will, like Haraway, who will continue to do that. Because I think she does it really, really well. Although I don't agree with her on everything, and I don't know if that symbiopoiesis is the answer, but I think it's certainly definitely something that she's put on our collective map.
She writes and talks about, in this same with the trouble that the I'm gonna mangle this, the Cthulhu scene, and then she goes through a whole, like, sort of, it's almost like a reverse engineering the etymology of it, because she's inventing the etymology of it, but it's a combination of chthonic, so earthy, microbial, etc., and then the monster, like the H.P. Lovecraft monster Cthulhu, which is a mythological huge beast that, you know, resides at the bottom of the sea and that gets awakened, you know, after the ages and, you know, arises in kind of a Godzilla. And she contrasts that with the Anthropocene, which still has anthropos or man at the center of it. And I take her point to be that we give ourselves too much credit as anthropos, and that the deeper power, like the more, the deeper power that's awakening, you know, through these mutations and these recombinations, the genetic, you know, swapping and this cyborg, you know, marriage between humans and technology is far more monstrous than I think just the notion that we're changing the climate, you know, that it goes. That's what I get from her. I like that because it's fun. Because I'm also a little boy, I like monsters and I like scary things. And in a way it sort of makes the universe a little bit more friendly. I'd rather live in the Cthulhu scene than the Anthropocene. The Anthropocene kind of gets, I think that's like the AI reduction of everything to the individual human perspective, and whatever is of, you know, optimized for, you know, our own ends. That's the private heavens, I think, that Butler is talking about. Like what I think what she describes is like VR, a VR fantasy world, you know, that we could each have. And I think that, I mean, Jaron Lanier and others have meditated on, you know, written about this, and what they see as the big social benefits of VR is that it would allow us to play out all of our dreams and fantasies, or would allow us to have all these wish fulfillments, etc. And you know, that would take the pressure off of, like, that psychic pressure off of the material plane, you know, the real world. But I don't know how that's going to play out. I really like the idea of social dreaming for that reason, because in social dreaming we do feel like we could have hyper empathy in the dream world, right? Or in the VR dream world, cyborg matrix, whatever that is, such that our dreams mattered in the sense that they had consequences, maybe just in that social realm, maybe in the material realm, but there'd be feedback loops basically, you know, built into it. And we would feel like what we put out, it would come back to us.
You know, when Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream," his dream came from the subtle realm. And many, many people started to vibrate with that. But what would happen if he had access to Jason Lanier's fantasy? He could just like put on Google goggles or whatever and get zapped. I think that would be potentially, because it's so risk-free, taking the pressure off the social, as Lanier and so many engineers want to do, would be ecological disaster. Because our eco-immunology requires that we register socially those effects. That, so it is not risk-free. And I am, as a member of a despised minority, gay people, in the 40s and the 50s, we barely existed except in on the underground. I would really, I think many of us resonated with Martin Luther King, who was also a member of, had a minority experience, that, you know, he could tap into the dreaming capacity, the social dreaming network that's under the surface, and start to move in many different directions, other liberatory human movements. So I think there is a rhizomatic aspect to this. It's not just hierarchical arrangements, but I think we need to have both. We need to have intelligent, flexible hierarchies and vibrant networks. And I believe that that's what, but they have to have risk. They can't be risk-free. But I do believe initially, and I've endorsed this idea, that we need to have safe to fail experiments at first, so that we can consolidate some sort of a social intelligence that then is resilient enough to take risks and then can go out and do things that may indeed fail. So I'm interested in creating a coherent enough we spaces so that we can then, that are cooperative, so that then we can compete in systems that, you know, are very unequal. Otherwise, we're just creating a little fantasy world, which I think is a big yawn. It would bore me shitless, because I want to go out in the world and be an agent again, as I was in previous stages of my development. I was thrust into extremely conflicted social spaces where my, and not only mine, but other people's identities were under a constant attack and surveillance. And I actually believe that it's even worse now, not as a gay person, but as a person. I believe that our personhood is being challenged by a lot of the current policy making. And then humans are not necessarily, it's not necessarily agreed on that all humans are persons. And I think that's a real big challenge for us. And creating a risk-free narcissistic little bubble where I can put on my goggles and get zapped by neurotransmitters without any risk, I think it's just the ultimate nightmare. I would much rather have a biological dream. You have a biological dream. We get together and share our social bio dreams together. That, I think, is social dreaming. And I believe that comes from a very deep roots. Many, many traditions have done that and had extremely beneficial impacts. And sometimes great risk. So,
you obviously gave us a lot to think about because we're all just quietly thinking now.
Well, I was thinking about next steps in terms of reading groups. So, sort of dipping into Haraway, I'm thinking, gee, that would be a nice one to do as a reading group. It's not fiction, though. It's a different kind of reading, but and it may be doable. It's sort of 8 chapters. It could be done in, you know, a 4-month chunk, I guess, every 2 weeks, a little bit like we've been doing for.
I think she's dense enough to warrant a group read. I mean, there's some writers that are manageable on my own and I don't need a group, but
right.
But she's approachable. I mean, she writes in a popular style, but it's still dense enough and the ideas are troubling enough to generate, I think, lots of different responses. So I'd say that's great. Your instincts about this are very good. I think reading was great, and I think this one's been great too, even though I wasn't able to contribute fully in it. But she's a very interesting writer and there's a lot of material on her, and she's also creating a movement. I'm very attracted to people who are creating movements.
Yeah. I'm just a little bit, because I'm so tied up this fall with other, I'm going to be traveling, I'm going to be in Colorado in 10 days, and then I'm going to be in France and Poland in November for 2 or 3 weeks, and so it's awkward for me to run it while I'm traveling, so I might wait until end of November before I start a new group. But
we're also finishing up that Aurobindo reading,
which is also quite demanding. Yeah.
So maybe that would be better timing at the end of November,
because
I don't think it'll take maybe 2 months, maybe 4 or 5 sessions, say chapters. Yeah,
it's just that I would space them every 2 weeks, just because you know, sometime I have to write my books. So
then we could do something on Gregory Bateson after we've worked on Haraway.
Yeah,
there's a relationship.
I think there's a thread there to be, you know, there's a, from Manning, Butler, Haraway. But as far as philosophy, like genre-wise, going from Manning to Haraway to Bateson. There's some continuity there.
And Johnny, you were talking about the relation between epistemology and ontology, and of course Bateson takes us back into the heart of that relationship, right? So we live in a world that has gone ontological and moved away from epistemology, except as a kind of utilitarian concept in sort of, you know, people who do methodology and science talk about epistemology, but they don't quite mean the same thing as we do when we talk about it, or Bateson means when he talks about it, epistemology. We've gone, everything's gone towards ontology, but of course ontology is a knowledge and epistemology is how do you frame knowledge? And so in a sense, you can't do ontology without epistemology, and there's a need to bring back the relationship between the two. Right. So I do feel that that's an important point that needs to be dealt with. So.
And Bateson also has two daughters.
Yes.
And I can't remember the name.
Nora.
And she's written a brilliant book fairly recently.
Yeah. And she's also, I noticed there's a conference coming up, I think, in Canada. I think, and Nora's going to, I need to look it up, but I think she's going to, I might try and get to the conference because
that would be worthwhile. I think her book was really fascinating because I think she's gone a little bit beyond her father. She draws upon him.
Yeah.
She elaborates a great deal. And I think she's adding something. She's updating him.
Yeah, she's updating. Yeah, exactly. So
I would like to ask Mary what you are interested in reading or what you are reading or how this all interacts with your writing or with, you know, you're also a scientist, so how that may play in as well.
That's a good question. I've been reading nonfiction lately. So Octavia Butler had been someone I wanted to read for a really long time because I'm excited about the sort of wave of Black female science fiction writers right now, and she's the grandmother of that phenomenon. How it fits in. It doesn't fit in directly with my own fiction writing, except in the sense that everything I read, I learn from how the author structures things. I mean, things that are on my to-read list are writers like Joe Walton, in terms of science fiction, are writers like Joe Walton, Michelle Baker, I'm looking sideways at my to read list, actually. It's a pile right here. Yeah, it's a mix. It's a mix. I'm reading some history books right now, but nothing too philosophical. I like science fiction writers that explore themes about disability and Octavia Butler did hit the spot pretty exactly for me on multiple fronts. So.
And Mary's working, you're working on a historical novel about the Norse. So I guess some of your reading would support that.
I don't even count that as my reading. I didn't think of it that way. Yeah, I'm writing a historical novel about, so much has been written about explorers in the North, and so much focuses on the big names of white European males like Franklin or whatever. And I'm trying to write those explorations from the perspective, from a non-human perspective, in fact, to decenter them and give them a different view.
In the north of Canada?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Northern Greenland and Northern Ellesmere Island. The big age of Arctic exploration in the late 19th century. So. Yeah.
Is that where you were doing research? Like when you were out recently in this expedition?
Well, not really. I mean, I'm a microbiologist and an environmental microbiologist, and I do a lot of field work in the Arctic. So I draw on that in the sense that I've been on scientific ships in the Arctic, and I'm writing about scientific ships in the Arctic just, you know, 130 years ago. But lots of things haven't really changed. So in terms of how people do things and how what it's like to be up there. So, yeah.
I'm very interested in the non-human turn. There were some philosophers, I think, were banding together around that. And I think Aaron Manning was one of them.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting area too. And if you know of any fiction writers or sci-fi writers who are exploring that, I'm sure there are. And I think a lot of our dreams are actually, I think a lot of my dreams have a lot to do with, is it interspecies or intraspecies or extra species communications and fast forwarding into future communiques. And I think a lot of that's becoming a part of our imagination as well. There's the philosopher, Jason Giorgiani is his name. I haven't read his book yet, but he's making that claim that, that a lot of our ET literature is actually, beings from a species, our future, they're coming back to us and trying to get us to self-correct and not make the mistakes that they made, but we have to get smarter. They say, we have this knowledge and you can have it, but you have to take it from us. That's the challenge, because we have to be smarter than they were in order for this knowledge to work. So I think that's that would be a very fun dream project. You know? But I think there's something that's drawing upon these communiques between species that I think is very, very interesting and compelling.
Hang on, I'm just going to interrupt. What I'd like to do is I'm going to stop the recording because I think I want to pursue the discussion slightly, because all four of us are part of the writers group and we're having a discussion now about including you in the writers group. So we can talk a little bit about that out of the context of the recording, if that's okay.
Sure, that'd be lovely.